Tonight on Arena, among the movies up for review, St. Francis and How to Build a Girl, and singer Muireann Na Gcaoilí gets ready for her Live at Windmill Lane concert. Five one double 51 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. Film first this evening, and in fact we've got four for you on this Thursday night. St. Francis, an accidental nanny finds an unlikely friendship with a six-year-old that she's minding. A conservative church choir director inherits her late son's San Francisco drag club in Stage Mother. How to Build a Girl is based on Kathleen Moran's novel of the same name about a teenage music journalist. And finally, French film Alice, about a single mother who will do anything to protect her son. I'm joined now by Michael Pope here in studio, and Cara Doherty joins us down the line. We'll start with St. Francis, written by and starring Kelly O'Sullivan as a character called Bridget, a rather underachieving character called Bridget. I had no idea what to expect when I started this film. And St. Francis is slightly misleading because it's all about Bridget in many ways, Cara, I would have thought.
It is. It's Bridget's story, but Frances is the little girl that is that she nannies. And Frances, by being a six-year-old, somehow manages to open up a whole new world for Bridget, and in fact for her parents. She's the child of a same-sex couple, and they're both struggling for different reasons. So through this little girl, they find a different way to navigate their lives.
I keep going to call her Frances because of the film's title. Bridget is a 30-something, Michael. She's a little bit lost.
Yeah, she's
it's
definitely
safe to say.
Stuck in a state of arrested development. You know, she's kind of waiting tables and she's reading Harry Potter. Not that there's anything wrong with that, but you know, the kind of implication is clear. She's at a loose end when we meet her. But in the first 2 minutes of the film or so, you kind of see that she has the tools to deal with what's going to come towards her, because although you said it's called St. Francis, it's very much Bridget's story, and in the first couple of minutes, it's kind of evident that we're going to take kind of a really refreshing, honest look at women's health, women's sexuality, and women's relationships, and that kind of factors in a lot of things like religion and guilt or guilt lack thereof, because if you've seen the trailer, you will know there's a very big decision made in the first 15 minutes of the film by Bridget, and it's a very dispassionate decision she makes. It's kind of it's enlightening and it's progressive, but it doesn't kind of hang over the whole film. It is about the connection with her and Frances. This is just something that's going on in her life at the same time.
Yeah, I'll come back to that because it's a very important part of the film. But let's have a listen to the kind of, I suppose, the sheer straightforward chemistry that is struck up between the young girl who plays the character of St. Francis, the little girl Francis, Ramona Edith Williams, and Bridget, played by Kelly O'Sullivan, who also wrote the script here. So here they are on one of their first days out, heading towards the park, when she's been nannied by Bridget.
So, what's your favourite colour? Hey, slow down.
How old are you?
How old do you think I am?
52.
Why do you think that?
Because that's how Linda was, and she was as slow as you.
I'm 34.
Do you have kids?
No.
Are you married?
No.
Do you have a boyfriend?
No.
A girlfriend?
No. Do you have a boyfriend or a girlfriend?
No.
Then we have something in common.
I'm tired.
We just started walking.
Will you carry me?
Let's go back and get the stroller.
No. We're almost there. It won't take long if you carry me.
The park is really close. Come on.
Do not believe a six-year-old when they ask you to carry them and they tell you that the park is really close. Ramona Edith Williams there playing the character of Frances, and Kelly O'Sullivan, the character of Bridget in the film St. Francis, which is the first of four that we have up for review this evening. Michael mentioned, Cara, how refreshing the take we get on a 30-something-year-old's life, how refreshing it is in this film. We're dealing with menstruation, the realities of, you know, difficult sex, or mediocre sex, possibly we should talk about, and also big decisions around an unexpected pregnancy. There's a lot that goes on in this film.
There's so much that goes on, and we just don't see this in film. And it's not done in a throwaway way. It's done in an open, frank, refreshing and funny way. I mean, women are not portrayed on screen as they really are. And it's almost to the point that you mentioned there's a lot of period talk in this film. And watching it, I was stunned because I haven't seen that. And I was almost worried about talking about it tonight because I was thinking, these aren't things we talk about. But we should. And that's why I really think this film could be a complete game changer in how we see women on screen.
Yeah, and not only that, we get the same-sex couple played by Charia Alvarez, plays the character of Maya, who's a very Catholic woman and suffering from postpartum depression as well. And then Annie, her wife, is played by Lily Mojekwu. Very different style of parenting. She's the kind of the go-getter of the couple. She's the one who's out doing earning the money at this particular point in time. And let's pick up on a clip where Annie, the wife, comes home to find Francis and Bridget dancing in the kitchen, dressed up as Joe Jett, because they both want to play the guitar.
You scared me.
Y'all look pretty scary yourselves.
Mama!
How you doing?
Francis is over. I'm Joan Jett now.
Well, Joan, let's go get you cleaned up.
It's not coming off.
I think it's waterproof.
Did you use your mascara on her? You really shouldn't have done that because Franny had pink eye this weekend.
Pink eye means it got poop in your eye.
Yes, it does.
I can never get her to nap.
I don't give her a choice.
Yes, style of parenting clear and on the button there.
Yeah,
when it comes to
the dynamic with those with the two parents is probably the strongest part of the film for me.
Yeah, that's Lily Mojekwu as Annie, one of the two mothers. And again, we had Kelly O'Sullivan in the midst of that clip. You were saying, Michael, about the dynamic.
Yeah, there is, like as you said, one of them is going through the kind of very religious one is going through postpartum depression, and that's very difficult to see on screen for one, and also for Bridget dealing with it. And then there's the go getter, as you said. These kind of interactions, though, I haven't really seen them portrayed like this in film ever, really. Like, there's a confrontation in a park where this woman comes up to the mother who's breastfeeding.
The Maya character, the other mother, yeah.
She's breastfeeding and she criticizes her openly. And you kind of see where this is going to go, this conversation. It's going to get escalated, they're going to give out to each other and they're going to walk away. But they have this completely original way of dealing with this conflict between the two of them. It's
amazing.
Quite remarkable to see this scene. I don't want to spoil it too much, but it doesn't end in a shouting match. It ends in almost like they all kind of realize that they're all human beings and they all have their own foibles and kind of like prejudices, as it were.
And it's the little girl who
Francis
kind of
is right in the middle of it.
She solves it brilliantly. Cara, I don't know whether maybe it was just emotional on a Thursday afternoon watching this film. I laughed and cried more in the hour and 40 minutes of this film than I've done for a long time. It seemed to be able to just swing you from one place to another very easily.
It's an absolute roller coaster, and it does. And it's the ease that it moves. And I think one of the wonderful things is that when you see women portrayed on screen in such a real way, you realise that not to sound too extreme, but when you kind of remove the shackles of so many things that we hide behind and the things that we're trapped in our own heads because of the fear of these difficult conversations, when you remove that, women have a remarkable ability to be free to go between emotions and take you on a journey where you can laugh, you can cry, and then you can give out to a 6-year-old toddler in the middle of it all.
Yeah, it really is a wonderful way it shifts from one thing to another. Let us get stars from you first of all, Cara.
Oh, without doubt, it's a 5-star for me. It's frank, it's witty, it's beautiful, it's perfectly cast, and that child is an absolute amazing child actor.
She is great, yeah.
So she gets a star all on her own.
Yeah, she's worth it. And finally from you, Michael?
It's a strong 4 out of 5, and I'm excited to say you can go see this in the cinema at the weekend.
I was just going to say, yeah, it has a limited cinema release. That's one of the first cinema releases we've had since lockdown.
I recommend it very much.
And you're going to go and see it, I believe.
I'm going to see it again, yes.
Yeah, on the big screen. So that should be nice as well. That's St. Francis, first of our 4 films this evening. Let us move on then to Stage Mother. Who is the stage mother in question here, Michael Pope? Of course, there are several stage mothers involved, really.
Following the sudden death of her very much estranged drag queen son from a drug overdose in San Francisco, it's small town church choir director in Texas, Maybelline, played by Jackie Weaver, is an Australian actress who really kind of only really started to be kind of someone we knew about 5 or 6 years ago. She heads out to the west coast of San Francisco to pay her respects and get her son's affairs in order. She's very conservative. She's very alone. Her husband doesn't want to go with her. She's grieving, and she's just inherited a failing drag bar called Pandora's Box, along with the problems of her grieving our son's grieving boyfriend, played by Adrian Grenier, and a lucky in love kind of building mate called Lucy Liu, and a host of very, very sad drag performers' personal struggles.
Brilliantly named drag performers. Pandora's Box, the name of the club, is only the start of this. You have the names in your notes, so I'll let you give them, Cara. So brilliant names here.
We have Cherry Poppins.
Yeah.
There's Joan of Arkansas. Tequila Mockingbird
was my favourite.
Absolutely one of the best. And then we have a drag mother also in it, Dusty Muffin.
Yeah. Let's listen to a little section from the trailer, and Dusty Muffin will explain a little bit more about herself in the midst of this.
Are you Ricky's mom from Texas? Ricky and I are best friends.
Is Ricky the baby's father?
Oh, definitely not.
Do you know who is?
Yeah, like 90-something%.
There you go. Police, keys, contracts. Ricky owned Pandora's Box.
Oh my Lord, I've inherited a gay bar.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Dusty Muffin. And I gotta warn you, this muffin has nuts.
I'd suggest you mingle, but I don't think you have much in common with this crowd.
Not really much of a crowd.
Is Mommy Dearest gonna be our new boss?
Do I call them boys or girls?
Well, it's kind of a time of day issue.
Our most popular performers just quit. Business is flatlining.
I have a plan.
What do you know about running a drag bar?
I'm a Southern Baptist choir mistress. Different songs, same divas. Some of the same wigs, too.
There you go. Who knew you could compare Southern Baptists and drag queens? But there it is, done in that section from the, what do you call it, the trailers for Stage Mother. Tom Fitzgerald is the director here. There's a good premise here, but somehow kind of never lifts off the ground for me at any rate, Michael.
It feels very obvious and very predictable. First of all, Jackie Weaver, she's great. She's got this kind of delicate, empathetic, kind of human quality.
I suppose
about
Silver
her.
Linings Playbook in particular
yes,
would
in particular,
be what people
yeah.
would know her from.
She's kind of running around, putting out fires, putting out emotional fires, curing drug addicts and setting up people with businesses and sorting out people's relationships with their parents. It's very predictable. It happens as you'd expect. It has a kind of a very TV kind of movie quality about it. Very much so. You can tell it's a kind of a micro budget thing. It's set in San Francisco, and something didn't ring true when I was watching this, because I kept seeing these glorious, high contrast, beautiful, high def shots of the Golden Gate Bridge and the Bay Area, and then we'd kind of cut to this kind of small, kind of scuzzy bar, which is clearly.
Yeah.
So I looked it up, and it was actually shot in Nova Scotia, in Canada, and the two don't really correlate for me. I would have liked to have seen to have got to know the city more, because the city is a mecca for the LGBT community in America, and I think it would have the film deserved to be set there properly. I feel that it was lacking something for me.
Yeah, I mean, I hadn't noticed particularly the stock shots, but I thought, you know, there's an awful lot happening inside in this film. All right, Cara. So that aspect of it didn't particularly bother me. But what about? It was more about the quality of the acting here, the quality of the script. It was all a bit on the nose or something.
It is uneven. I will say that Adrian Grenier's character, who's the bereaved boyfriend, he's a vital character, and he's very underwritten. I would think we should have seen more of him. But yes, I agree with the kind of the scenes, the outdoor shots not exactly tallying right. But there is a lot of sweetness in this. It is very feel good. I mean, it is serious issues, but it's dealt with in a very nice way. So although quality-wise, it isn't the finest of films. It certainly is very enjoyable and heartwarming. And I think it's hard to be hard on something that has that much heart. Mm. It is trying its best. It just doesn't always work.
What about the whole the way it shows us drag culture itself and the performances within drag clubs? How does that work, Michael?
Well, it doesn't really address it. I mean, the pantomime and the lip syncing nature of it. You're kind of assumed that you know this. I would have liked to know more about the history of it because I don't really know that much about it. Mm. I didn't really get that. And as for something that so rarely gets, it's very popular in the small screen, RuPaul's Drag Race and such, but it doesn't really get the big screen treatment ever, really. So I found myself that the fact that it was more or less about Jackie kind of going around and curing drug addicts and teaching drag performers how to sing and harmonise, I kind of felt it was doing the overall kind of idea a disservice because I expected it to delve deeper and I expected more, as Cara was saying, from Adrienne Grenier's character. It's a very interesting character. And the same with Lucy Liu, but unfortunately they get a couple of scenes each.
Lucy Liu is the mother of a child and the Jackie Weaver character spends a lot of time in apartment.
And I expected more kind of substance. I mean, as I got fed up with the film, I started to consider myself quite a monster because it was meant to be feel good. There's singing and dancing montages, but at the same time, it all rang a bit hollow for me.
Okay, so stars then from you, Michael.
I'll give it two.
You're saying two. What are you saying, Cara?
Oh, he is a monster. I'm going to go with three. It's just for that feel good factor. It tries, and I think it's very sweet. So.
It is the sort of film that you could turn into a cult film before too long, where you'd be repeating lines and singing the numbers. I think that could happen to it, funnily enough.
Certainly, the last 10 minutes with the big numbers,
the big musical numbers towards the end. Stage Mother is the title of that film. It's in cinemas as well, and it's on general release. When cinemas get back up and running properly in the coming weeks. Let us move on then to film number three this evening, How to Build a Girl, based on the semi-autobiographical novel by Kathleen Moran. Who are we talking about here? The Kathleen Moran character essentially is Johanna Morrigan in this realisation, Cara.
She's played by Beanie Feldstein, who was absolutely fabulous in Olivia Wilde's Booksmart. She's playing a 16-year-old nerdy girl. It's 1993. She wants to be a writer. Her dream is to walk around the corner and find Mr. Darcy or a great Austonian character. And these things aren't really working out for her until she gets an opportunity to try her hand in the writing world.
We better get this out of the way first of all. You can't get any clips from this particular film, but you, Michael, had a real problem.
You're spared
the Wolverhampton accident. Well, I spent some time several accidents, isn't it?
I spent some time in Wolverhampton when I was in college. So maybe I was a little too familiar with the accent, but Beanie goes from the Black Country, which is kind of Wolverhampton, Coventry and all that, to the West Country, to East London, to Islington. Maybe she might skip continents, go to Australia with her accent at one point, and then
very
back.
Harsh.
It's kind of somewhere between East Anglia. I don't really know. It was very distracting for me. No, she is a great performer and her comedic timing is perfect.
That's what I was going to say, despite that,
absolutely. Yeah, I just had to get that out of the way. And it was the first thing. Even in my head, I was like, okay, Michael, you're going to have to see past this. We're 10 minutes in and this is a really good kind of whimsical, kind of light touch. Especially considering it is set in 1990s Wolverhampton, which does not look like a very nice place, but it's got this kind of heightened fairy tale tone to it a lot of the time, which does work in its favour.
Yeah, and it's set in the world of rock music journalism, and a lot of men children involved in that particular occupation in 1990s Wolverhampton, I hasten to add, Cara.
It's literally, they're all man-childs, there's a new word for you. So she gets caught up in this world and she gets an opportunity to review something and it goes well the first time. So bit by bit, they give her a little bit more work. But when they give her a feature, which she has doggedly asked for, she writes it, as they say, like a 16-year-old girl, which she is. And they're not happy about this. So she decides the only way to fit in and to work is to become a hard-as-nails, nasty critic and go to their level, which will ultimately result in her winning an award for Asshole of the Year before she realises this isn't really the place for her either. But she certainly is there to try and shake up their world anyway.
The other thing, a very important series of cameos in this. Now, I didn't see the film, but are the cameos actually animated? Do the pictures on her teenage bedroom wall. Do they speak to her, or do they are they just photographs?
She's got these inspirational figures all over her bedroom wall. Now, I tried to keep track of them because there's actually a lot of them, and I didn't realize that one of them was Michael Sheen. But yeah, we've got like Lily Allen is Elizabeth Taylor. But the kind of Jameela Jamil plays Cleopatra, who doesn't say a word. Sharon Horgan is Jo March. Mel and Sue from television are the Bronte sisters, which I didn't expect. It's kind of it's all set up in kind of a playful tone, though, which works for the film.
And did they actually, do you know, did they speak to her?
Well, they speak to her until she becomes a mean spirited, impossible to please music critic. They kind of start to ignore her then. But yeah, and it's also lots of other kind of as a colourful supporting cast in this. It's really good. Paddy Considine is kind of this aging, over the hill rocker who is still, you know, he's kind of naive. And you've got Alfie Allen, particularly.
Game of Thrones Alfie Allen.
Yeah. Reek from Game of Thrones. He brings real warmth and pathos to this, what could have been a really stock role as kind of an angst-ridden rock and roller. But he's actually remarkably good, as is Laurie Kingston as Dolly's bedroom mate and brother. He's very, very good.
Sex, drugs and rock and roll in any I would have thought rock and roll film. Do we get all three, and how is it handled in this, Cara, or is it too whimsical for all of that?
No, we certainly get it. The drugs are something that she doesn't want to go down that road, but it's there. But she certainly discovers drink, and she certainly learns what sex is all about. But it's nicely done. We see things happening, but we don't see it in detail, which I think is great, because I think this is a lovely film for teenagers and people who, you know, are entering into this whole new world. So yeah, nicely done. It just doesn't go, it's not for the sake of it.
And I don't know if I'm getting this right at all, Koki Giedroich is
I was wondering about that. I tried to find a pronunciation of it online. I was getting no help at all.
Koki. He or she?
I got it. It's she. It's Giedroich, and she's actually Mel and Sue's, no, Sue Mel, which is I'm always muddling those two.
Yeah, she's a sister, isn't she?
She's the sister of Mel or Sue. Anyway, I was very proud of myself for figuring this out.
Okay, so stars from you on How to Build a Girl, Michael Pope.
I'll give it 3 out of 5. It's quite good.
3 out of 5 from Michael. And what are you saying, Cara?
Oh, I had to get it 4. It's just gorgeous. And I really think I ended up crying in the final scene. I got very emotional. And I thought there was a lovely backdrop of this idea that oftentimes working class kids can't grow up to work in the arts or to fall into that world. And there's a lovely kind of thing that you can. And I think it's, yeah.
So your inner Joanna Morrigan, who's the character in the film, was tickled by this, was she, Cara?
Absolutely. I can say, as a working class kid, you grew up to be a critic and is on the national radio now, I can tell you. You'll have to
get nasty, though, like Joanna, at some point along the way. Let's move on. So what did you say stars-wise? Sorry.
Four stars.
Let's move on then to final film for this evening, Alice, French film directed by Josephine Maceiras, a story of Alice, a wife and mother. Perfect family, loving husband.
Oh, yeah.
Although he's expressing his love far too loudly in the first scene.
I did not enjoy that. Yeah.
So, but he disappears quite quickly.
Yeah, they have this idyllic home life. They've got perfect chemistry, nice dinner parties and an adorable kid for about the first 4 minutes of the movie. And then he goes missing. And not in kind of a crime thriller way. Mm. He just has emptied their bank accounts. And after some sleuthing, she discovers he's addicted to expensive escorts and has left her penniless and about to lose her home in about 3 weeks. So she's desperate and she's traumatised.
And she's got the phone number of these elegant
She's trying to discover how much could these women possibly charge? How much has her husband been blowing away on this? And she finds herself drawn into that world of high-end sex work.
The film then goes from this world of the perfect family into this perfect wife and mother being dragged into the world of high-end sex worker. How does it handle the kind of difficulties that world presents and the dilemmas that world presents, Cara?
It does it really well, in a somewhat like St. Francis, in a way that I haven't seen before. It's done, there's no shame to it. It's a choice that she makes. She befriends another escort, Lisa, played by Chloe Boreham, who kind of shows her the ropes. And it's very much done from the point of view of these are women who've made a choice that they found a way to work, that they can earn lots of money and that they can afford what they need to. So there's no shame thrown at them for it. The interesting point is later on when the rotbag of a husband turns up again and he finds out that his wife has turned to prostitution and he threatens her with it, that he says he'll take the child away. And the difficulty is at that point, in the eyes of the law, he may have spent all of their money and almost left them homeless, but that doesn't make him a bad father. It just makes him a bad husband.
I know.
But in the eyes of the law, it makes her an unfit mother. And it's the same game they've both fallen into. They're just on very different sides of it. So it really is shown from a very different and refreshing perspective on sex workers.
And we get the performance. It really relies on the, there is, I suppose, the Lisa character is important, the Chloe Borum side of things. But it really depends on Emily Papponier's performance. She has to go through this, you know, abandoned woman, yeah, with no money in her bank account, through all sorts of emotional roller coasters from there on, Michael.
Yeah, and in particular, like, I mean, the first act is fairly breathless. I mean, she's an escort within the first 25 minutes, and that might seem like a stretch, but she has no hope. She's no contact with her husband. She's no compassion from her mother. So it all does fall on Pipponier's shoulders. And can we kind of watch her? She's in almost every scene. Her fragility kind of morphs into this resolve and then into this confidence. And after her first, this is the film where, this is the moment where I really realised that I was kind of watching something quite unique. After her first client, she's walking along with her friend Lisa, and she says, I don't feel any different.
Yeah.
And it's that kind of refreshing kind of honesty that is, for me, sets this film apart even more than St. Francis. I had never even thought of that. It didn't really bother her all that much. The spell of her previous life has just been broken. Yeah.
The other aspect of that is, I mean, her first encounter as a prostitute with a client, it's almost got a slapstick comedy quality to it, Cara, and the film seems to be able to move from that slapstick comedy into very serious topics around the things like, you know, trafficking and sex workers versus women, like the two characters we're presented with, who we are told made the choice to do what they're doing. It seems to be able to move between those kind of hilariously funny areas and quite difficult areas very easily.
It does. I mean, the first time that she's with somebody, she is a nervous wreck. She's jittery. She can barely get her own clothes off. She's that much of a wreck. And quite quickly, she realises that this is something she has actually been doing all her life and in a different way. But now it's for work, and she builds on that confidence. And it does. It changes the dynamic the more she gets used to that life, and the more herself and Lisa talk about this is a career now for them. But they do talk about the fact that it's not the life for everybody. And yes, of course, there are people who fall into it in terrible circumstances. But it really has this very clever way of taking us through it in this kind of very refreshing way. And I have to say, it is directed by a woman, and I don't recall seeing a film focused on prostitutes where we actually see so little of the sex scenes, which I think is fantastic. I mean, they're there, you know it's happening, but we're not seeing everything, and we really don't need to. It's not really about it. It's about the job that it actually entails.
For all of that, I kind of knew where this film was going almost from the first scene. It was very, even though it was really enjoyable, predictable.
The ending was a complete blessed relief to me. I thought it was going to go a certain way up until about 5 minutes to go. And I was, Francois comes back with his hypocrisy and his double standards
and his
manipulation, I was really, really worried that this was going
to... So you loved it?
Yeah, I did. Yeah, yeah.
Stars from you, Michael.
I'll give it 4 out of 5.
Four from Michael. And what are you saying, Cara? Did you find it as predictable as me or not?
No, I thought it was going a very particular way, and I would have put money it was going in a certain way. And the direction it took definitely surprised me, so I'm going with 4 stars as well.
All right, 4 from Cara O'Doherty for Alice as well. Michael Pope and Cara O'Doherty talking to us about How to Build a Girl, available on Amazon Prime from tomorrow. St. Francis Limited Cinema release, Stage Mother General release, and Alice released it on selected digital platforms, including Amazon Prime. From the lyricism of the Gypsy Ballads of 1928 to the rural trilogy of Blood, Wedding, Yerma and the House of Bernard Alba, Federico Garcia Lorca has established himself as one of the foremost poets and dramatists in Spain. In his work, he's become synonymous with the Andalusian culture he wrote so much about, and in his death, with the turbulent years of the Spanish Civil War. Here to tell us more about him is Stephen Roberts, author of Deep Song, The Life and World of Federico Garcia Lorca. I suppose, Stephen, when you take on to write this story of Lorca, were there a number of mythologies around Lorca that you wanted to burst or that you wanted to examine?
Yes. First of all, thank you very much for having me. It's a real pleasure to be here. Absolutely, Sean. There's no question about that, because probably of all 20th century Spanish writers, perhaps all 20th century writers, Lorca is the most mythologized, there's no doubt about it. And for very good reason, obviously, because of the excellence of his work, but also because of the circumstances of his death. Mm.
He was assassinated during the Spanish Civil War, and his remains have never been located.
Exactly, absolutely. Which means, of course, that he has become a symbol of victimhood of the war itself, but continues to be a symbol in Spain, obviously, because of the law of historical memory and the rights that people supposedly have to find the remains of their loved ones. So what I've tried to do, not so much deny the mythologies, but get to the root of them, to go beyond them, to get back to the life as it was lived, and try to see what Lorca was like. And I think as other people have found, to look at a very joyous person. Very often biographies are written in a rather tragic way, going gradually towards the death. I've tried to keep the death out of it until the death arrives in the final pages of the work, so that we could see a very complex life, a very rich life, a very joyous personality, and celebrate the man and also celebrate the work, of course, as well, which is probably what I most wanted to do.
Well, let's take a look then, before we get to the death as well. Let us take a look at, the life and the work and the different influences that fed into that. He grew up in rural Spain, but I think he was the age of 11, 10 or 11 when they moved to the capital of Granada. How significant was that shift from rural to urban?
Very, very significant. I think that people right to the end of Lorca's life recognised the fact that he had been brought up in rural Spain. They could tell from the way he spoke, the way he moved. So it was an integral part of his being. And of course, he was there until, as you say, 11. So it's quite a traumatic moment to make such a large move. He adapted well to Granada, but he also found Granada a difficult place or there were certain aspects of its culture, above all its middle-class culture, he found difficult to come to terms with. And in fact, his writings remain more influenced by the Vega, the rural Granada that he knew, than by Granada, the capital city, for much of his life. And he went back over and over again to the rural Granada that he knew better, in a sense.
And in fact, I suppose that rural Granada is probably what informs a lot of the work that people will think of when they think of Lorca, like those gypsy ballads that I mentioned, and like the big rural trilogy of plays that came later in his life. But one thing that you do pick out in the book quite early on, Stephen, is this idea of puppet theatre and how important it was in Lorca's life. Is that a particularly Andalusian type of culture, or was it something Lorca latched onto himself?
I'm glad you brought that up, really, because I love puppet theatre myself. He latched onto a particular form of Andalusian puppet theatre, which he'd known as a boy in the villages to the north of Granada. There'd be itinerant puppet masters who'd go around and put on little plays. But by the time he became an adolescent and a young man, that was dying out. And Lorca was a man very, very aware of traditions that were being lost. And that was one of the ones that he particularly wanted to hang on to, so much so that he was a very close friend of Manuel de Falla, the composer at that time. And the two of them put together a project which would actually tour the Andalusian form of puppetry around Europe. And there's a wonderful moment when we hear that Falla goes to see Lorca, knocks on the door and says, "I'll get my friends Stravinsky and Ravel involved in all of this, and we can actually take all of this to Europe and Latin America." And never happened, but Lorca was very excited about it. And ever after that, incorporated aspects of puppetry and the art of puppetry into his poetry, not just into his plays. And that particularly interests me.
The term cante, excuse my pronunciation here, cante jondo, what exactly does that mean? What does it refer to?
Jondo is the way in which Lorca captures the Andalusian accent. It's cante hondo in Spanish with an H, but because of the aspiration in Andalusia, it makes it cante jondo. It literally means deep song, and it's the term that Lorca, he doesn't invent it, but it's a term that he uses to refer to what he believes is the authentic flamenco, not the flamenco of the taverns and the tourists, but the actual flamenco, which again he thought was dying out in his day. But again, working closely with Falla, they contacted a whole series of normally quite old, normally men as well, more than women, who sung this type of flamenco, which is often called siguirilla in Spanish as well, and put on a competition in 1922. And for this reason, to this day, Lorca is seen as someone who played an essential role in hanging on to a tradition of flamenco, which would have been lost probably without this attempt to hold on to it.
But there's an interesting kind of ambiguity around his attitudes here. Maybe it's not ambiguous. He had absolute disdain for this tourist representation of the culture. But he also was annoyed at the locals who seemed to then take on that culture and accept it as the real thing, the tourist version.
Yes, absolutely. I think his one thing I noticed looking at his early works is that he's complaining about the middle classes in Granada, but he's not complaining about the French and the English romantic writers and their version of Granada. So what he thought was that the local middle class bought into a rather Baudelaireized version of the romantic version of flamenco and Granada identity, because they thought it was something they could put forward as a badge of their own identity, but also attract the tourists. And that's what he most despised. He had a very romantic idea always that there's the authentic that lies beyond the superficial version of things. Yes.
And in many ways, it was the gypsy ballads that sort of captured that in some ways and became a big popular hit, and which kind of went against maybe what he wanted in some ways. But what I want to get on to is you mentioned about De Falla saying, oh, I'll bring my friends Stravinsky and Ravel along to the party here. Lorca didn't need friends like Stravinsky and Ravel. He had plenty of his own. He had De Bunuel was in there, Louis Bunuel was there, and Salvador Dali as pals.
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, that of course is the one thing I really want to do in this book as well, is to celebrate Spanish culture, which is so little known in the UK at least. And just to celebrate a nation whose culture was at the very, very cutting edge of the avant-garde in the 1920s. And obviously, it's become a mythical reality. You know, the coincidence, the time they spent together studying Luis Buñuel, Dalí, and Lorca. Who becomes the masters in sense of surrealist painting, of surrealist filmmaking, and I wouldn't say surrealist poetry in the case of Lorca, but surrealist inflected poetry, let's put it that way. But what a wonderful, wonderful time of expansiveness, excitement. I really wanted to celebrate that. And at the same time, the other thing I was trying to do while looking at all of that, which is very well known, is to look more closely at the writings themselves. I think it's a real privilege to be, in my case, a Hispanist, or, you know, to have a foreign language, have another language. So you can actually go in and gradually get to know how a poet like Lorca is playing with Spanish, is being creative, is going away from standard Spanish. And I wanted to get something of that into this biography as well, some sense of the language, which really, of course, was his main tool as an artist.
Another important aspect of the relationship with Dali is not just the artistic side of it, but the personal side of it. An unrequited love, really, a sexual love that perhaps Lorca wanted, but Dali walked away from.
Exactly, absolutely. There was certainly an attraction, I think a mutual attraction, without doubt. Dali, who becomes a very strange figure, if you like, for the late 1930s onwards, and very playful, In sometimes a rather cruel way when talking about the past. One thing he never, ever is cruel about is Lorca. Lorca remains for him the most important figure in his life, I think, alongside Gala, his wife. So I think that there was a huge attraction, but Dalí rejected the sexual side, but remained a very, very close friend, although Buñuel, unfortunately, dragged Dalí away from Lorca for several years, from about 1928 till 35. But apparently in 35... Lorca and Dalí reunited, and he could also get to know Gala at that point as well.
In the 30s, of course, we're dealing with the period leading into the Spanish Civil War, with the fall of the dictatorship of de Rivera and then the formation of the Second Republic. I think you don't question around whether Lorca's politics were on the left, but you do say he was perhaps, you know, it wasn't quite as black and white as it's sometimes portrayed to be, that there was ambiguity around his politics.
Absolutely. I think this is one of the mythologies I was most interested in getting under the skin of, so to speak. Because, of course, Lorca in the 1970s and 80s was turned into a symbol of what was to come, that return to democracy and liberal democracy and the victory of the Socialist Party in 1982. And in a sense, people have looked back from there, have tried to see Lorca's trajectory in those terms. There's no doubt, and I would never deny, that Lorca's heart was more to the left than the right. But I would look at it more as a liberal, a left-leaning liberal, who was very attracted to, but scared, very, very scared by the violence of the extremes. And therefore, as time went on, he became more and more uneasy with the polarization of politics in Spain, and also with the attempt by friends such as Rafael Alberti to get him to come along and declare himself a socialist or a communist. He, for many different reasons, didn't want to do that. His heart was with the left, but I think that he was more careful in his pronunciations. And in part, and this is something I've really wanted to get at, Lorca is so interesting because of the seeming contradictions. I'm not sure they are contradictions when seen in the context, but he was a man deeply attracted to tradition, deeply attracted to popular culture, deeply Catholic in his own way, in a very, very specific way, in a way which Falla, in the end, found very distasteful. But all these things are there in the mix with Lorca. Yeah.
Well, finally, then, let me come to the death, because, I mean, the general acceptance would be that he was killed by the right-wing side of the the Spanish Civil War, and that was why he died. But you are saying that there were other factors involved here, his sexuality, and perhaps family feuds, old family feuds, some of which we get given to us in the Rural Trilogy, in the House of Bernarda Alba and Yerma, and I think in particular, and even in Blood Wedding, we get this sense of, you know, families who are so closely knit that in fact they could kill each other as well as love each other. Do you Absolutely. Think that the death is, again, more ambiguous than we are given to believe?
I'm not sure it's more ambiguous. I think there are more reasons than are normally given. I'm not doubting at all the fact that he was seen as a man of the left, that he had attacked the middle classes and the bourgeoisie of Granada, that he was seen as gay, and that was seen as very reprehensible by the right. All these are definitely part of the picture. But recent research over the last 10 years, above all by local historians in Granada, have pointed to the family feud that lies behind the death as well. Amongst the people who arrested him, and even amongst those who shot him, there were distant family members who'd been involved with feuds over land with Lorca's father, dating back to the 1890s, the 1900s. It's a complex story, but I think we cannot overlook that anymore, and that it has to be given its proper place. That unfortunately, as in all civil wars, there is that element of brother against brother, cousin against cousin. And that certainly is a factor in Lorca's death.
Stephen Roberts there, and Stephen is the author of a new book on the life of Lorca, Deep Song, The Life and World of Federico García Lorca. It's published by Reaction Books. This weekend sees the second in a series of live music events presented by the Seamus Ennis Arts Centre in Nall, County Dublin, streamed from Windmill Lane Recording Studios in Dublin's Docklands. The interactive concerts bridging the gap between performers and people at home. You can watch it on your phone, your smart TV, and you can send messages and requests, and you might even have your face projected onto a wall of the studio where the musicians are performing. Singing live this Saturday will be Miriam McGowley, along with musicians Jerry O'Byrne and Donal O'Connor, and we're in judgment of Balian na Gael in Cúnti Kiri. It's wonderful that you might actually have an audience, even if it's just projected onto the back wall of the studios. Miriam,
I know, I'm so excited to actually see some faces out there. How are you, Sean? It's nice to talk to you, by the way.
Yeah, and you.
Yeah, it's very exciting. It's been 4 months, so just to be able to actually perform live and not into my phone, but to have a proper crew, multi-camera, you know, the highest quality of sound. Mm. It's just, I'm really excited and really grateful to be doing it. Yeah, yeah.
And I mean, in some, I don't know whether it's lucky or unlucky what happened with the album, the new album, Heart In, Seaborn, if we could give it that English translation. 2 days before lockdown, you released it?
Yeah, didn't I time it well? Yeah, so I was after doing one or two shows. We played in Antheivjark and Dolans. And it was the night we were in Dolans that Leo Varadkar had just announced that the schools were about to close and there were no gatherings over 100. And we kind of knew this was it, you know. So it was a poignant kind of gig, actually. Just kind of, I was acutely aware that it might be the last one for quite some time. And I think we all really appreciated it, the musicians and the audience. But yeah, definitely bittersweet.
It must have been a very particular atmosphere that night, knowing this is kind of our last. Did we know at that stage it would last as long as it would, as we're going to last?
Yeah, I mean, I had the fear that it might be a long time. And the two lads that I play with, Jerry and Donal, are brilliant. You know, they're like family. And one of them was saying, oh, this is just a blip. It'll be the blink of an eye. And then the other guy was saying, oh, we won't be on stage again for at least a year. So I was kind of listening to both of them and not knowing what was coming next.
Yeah, what was actually going to happen.
Yeah, yeah.
You're talking about chatting into your phone.
Yeah.
Because I want to play Fuish of Fuishtina, which is about chatting of a different kind, I suppose. Maybe you'd explain that title to us first of all.
So Fuish of Fuishtina means, I suppose, the relief of confession. And it's a song, the lyrics were composed by a friend of mine, Donal McSheehy, who sadly passed away a couple of years ago. And you might be aware of him, Sean, from the film Camino na Soila.
He was a
boatman and a poet and a wonderful character, sadly missed. And my friend Jerry O'Byrne, then he put beautiful music to this poem. Danny gave me the poem a number of years ago to turn into a song and thankfully heard it before he passed away. But it's actually a really positive song, and it's about connecting with the landscape and with the sea and communing with it. And, you know, that you can learn so much from it, and you can tell it your secrets and they'll be safe.
Well, let's have a little listen to a couple of verses. Fuish of Fuishtina from Mirren na Gaeilge.
Parlam agus van lam, theil na faile suas in norde, scrollach garv hin sara. Parlam agus van fara.
Little section there from Fuish of Fuishtina, one of the songs on Mirren na Gaeilge's new album Heart Thin, Seaborn. And Mirren speaking to me this evening ahead of her performance as part of the streamed gigs from Windmill Lane Recording Studios, presented by the Seamus Ennis Arts Centre in Nall in County Dublin. There's a line in the midst of that song wherein you can tell your secrets to the sea and find solace there. I suppose your own name suggests that you would have a large connection with the sea in the first place. Mirren itself is a derivation of the word for sea, I presume.
It is, yeah. It means sea maiden. And I suppose, yeah, I've just had a very strong connection with the sea, always living on islands as I did for many years as a child. And then I suppose the closest thing to an island since then, the tip of the Dingle Peninsula, looking out on the Blaskets. So, you know, in the midst of an ever-changing world, it's kind of been my constant. And certainly during lockdown, it was a great source of solace. So there was plenty of swimming going on.
Well, as you were describing it there, I was just thinking, not a bad place to be locked down on the tip of the Dingle Peninsula.
Know. And I was acutely aware of that. I really was thinking of people, you know, who weren't in such fortunate positions, because really and truly, it is the most beautiful place. And even when we had 2 kilometres, we had so much, you know, to draw from there. So it really was great. But we had our moments as well, of course.
Well, who didn't? Let's be realistic about it too. Although the sea it's not all, you know, lovely, contemplative, telling your secrets to the sea and they'll be carried off in the tide and nobody else need hear them other than the sea itself. in the song Falarine Lou, which is a Scots Gaelic song, I believe, it's a bit of possibly the harsher side of the sea.
Well, absolutely. I mean, there's always that duality there. The sea was something that, you know, it gave us food. It was a means of travel. But, you know, it was always very, very dangerous. And certainly the older people, when I was growing up, they would never swim. You know, they thought we were mad going into the water. And it was just about respecting it and being careful. And I remember hearing actually long ago that fishermen didn't learn to swim because it was thought that if the sea wanted to take you, that was, you know, that was what should happen, because if you didn't let her take you, she would take someone belonging to you. So you shouldn't fight it. Mm. But anyway, this song, Ar Feadh Uinniu, yeah, it's from Scotland. And I travel over to Scotland a lot, and I have many musical friends over there, such as Julie Fowlis. And I've just become so fond of the place. We're culturally connected, you know, and it's such a strong link between music and just generally way of life. So it's always a wonderful place to visit.
And I wonder then, when you are over there, you know, obviously your own Gaeilge would be Gaeilge Mún, you'd have the Munster Irish. But
yeah,
when you're in Scotland and you're listening to Scots Gaelic and Julie Fowlis and the like, is it like a trip to Donegal? Is it that foreign a language?
I nearly understand the Scots better. I actually brought Julie to Donegal once. We were doing a gig and I said to her, now their Irish is very different to mine, so you just stick with me and I'll translate for you. And the two, like Julie and the Donegal people, got on great, and I remember just sitting wordlessly, not knowing what was going on for the evening. So yeah, it's just another dialect, the Gaelic, you know. And it totally makes sense.
But I would have thought Julie probably understood it better. I remember a situation as a child being given a mass leaflet, and it was a relative priest asked me to read the thing, and I read it now, and he said, "What language do you think that is?" And I said, "Oh, is that Irish in the phonetics of Donegal?" And in fact, it was Scots Gaelic.
Yeah. Well, I mean, if you look at the line, if you just draw a line, turn it all onto the side, it's just a continued coastline all the way up, you know. So there are cousins.
They are that. Six tracks on the album. Did you want to go for compact, short and to the point? Was that the plan?
As a friend said to me, it's all killer and no filler.
Oh yeah, I like that. Have you an Irish phrase for that now? There must be a phrase
to come up with something.
You must do.
It was a very considered choice to stick to the six tracks that I felt were strong and had a strong theme and link to the sea, and maybe just the idea of the album changing a little bit now. And so few people sit down and listen to, you know, if you put your heart and soul into 12 tracks, are people really going to listen all the way through? And so maybe to just release a little and often, you know, so it's just a new way of looking at it, really.
How do you feel in the long term then about things? Obviously, this gig coming up at the weekend is great, and that's super. But who do you think is closer to the mark? Was it Jerry who said, "This is only a blip; it's a couple of weeks"?
And no, Donald, it was the other way around.
It was the other way. So Jerry was saying at least a year. Donald was saying a week or two. What do you think yourself? When would you think you might get back to ordinary gigs with an audience sitting in front of you?
Oh God, that's a hard question, Sean. And I wish I could say really, really soon. I think most importantly, everybody has to stay safe. We have to be careful. We have to get our kids back to school. We have to mind each other. But music is so, so important. And I know, especially to Irish people, the arts is, you know, hugely intrinsic in our communities and in our culture. So I really, really hope that it comes soon. And I also think it's really important that the government don't forget the musicians who, you know, are going to be the last people who get back to work.
Yeah, there's support needed there for sure. Well, listen, Gormila Machagata Svetling and Ochtmurin August Ganari Lat Leshen Gig this weekend, and indeed whenever we get you back on stage, it'll be lovely to see you up here at some point along the way.
Míle beagas.
Slán na an Íslán. That's Muir an na Gaeilge an Sin with Gerry O'Byrne and Donal O'Connor this Saturday night, 8 o'clock, for a live concert streamed from the Windmill Lane Studios in Dublin in partnership with the Seamus Ennis Arts Centre. Tickets are available from the Seamus Ennis Arts Centre website, TSEAC. The SeamusArtsCentre.ie, and Muireann's new album can be found on her own on Spotify and also on her website, Muireann, Muireann.ie. That is our lot for this evening. Leah Murphy and Paula Shields researched. Gar Duffy was the sound supervision tonight. Janice Murphy was the broadcast coordinator. Tonight's programme produced by Kay Sheehy. Talk to you tomorrow night at 7.